For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Our first guest on the show today is David Bromwich. He teaches literature at Yale. He's written on politics and culture for The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Review of Books, and other magazines. He is the editor of Edmund Burke's Selected Writings on Empire, Liberty, and Reform, and co-editor of the Yale University Press edition of On Liberty. He's, as I was saying earlier in the show, one of my favorite writers to be found at the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show, David. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good to talk to you. You got a great article here, the AIPAC case in Washington, Iraq, and beyond. And I really appreciate the perspective brought up in this. It's something that, you know, tying in the Iraq angle and really going back over some of the real history and context about the recent AIPAC scandals, various stories about AIPAC in the news. I guess let's start with, you know, easy for new people, and I hear people ask actually quite often, what is AIPAC, David?
Well, it's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, I believe. It's sometimes thought of as a political action committee, but officially it is not that.
Officially it is not a political action committee.
That's right.
And so what can you tell us about, you know, in the larger sense, besides the scandals, you know, the history of it, the relative influence in D.C., that kind of thing?
The founding of it, you may have the year better than I do. It goes back to, am I right, the 70s? Would that be correct?
I honestly don't know when it was founded, to tell you the truth.
But it is, you know, an organization that's become very strong in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when on the highest of Jewish holidays, Israel was attacked, and there was real fear for its existence. That word has since turned into the adjective of, you know, existential threat. But a lot of American Jews responded very strongly to this feeling of threat. And between the 1967 war, which was seen as a sort of heroic resistance against a combination of Arab powers trying to throw Israel and the Jews into the sea, and that 1973 war, this internal organization grew up in the U.S., and it's become notably stronger in the Clinton and Bush years. I would say these last two administrations, 1992 to 2008, have been, you know, seen a tremendous growth in the power of AIPAC, which is seen in petitions. It circulates among congressional representatives and senators, petitions that, you know, move against Israel's enemies and to support Israel's various military and geopolitical ventures. It's lobbying to oppose UN condemnations or censures against Israel of various sorts, where often the United States is the main or the only ally of Israel opposing, for instance, this or that action against the Palestinians taken by Israel. So, I mean, AIPAC is a, you could say, the strong American organ for financial and political support of central Israeli causes, causes that are important to the mainstream of Israeli politics. In the Bush years, it was criticized for being so close to the Likud party, the party of initially of Ariel Sharon before he shifted to something else called Kadema. But Likud and Kadema are both right-wing parties in Israel. And AIPAC is known to support whatever is the strong party in Israel at the moment. And in the past many years, that has been right, which is to say expansionist party, expansionist with regard to the settlements mostly, and, you know, slow in its recognition of the idea of a Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, one quick footnote here. Azoth, in the chat room, I think it was, says that AIPAC was founded in the 1950s.
In the 50s, so there you have it.
And then the other thing is something that you bring up there about the, I guess, right-wing nature of the Israel lobby and their support of, I guess, you think it's really mostly they basically toe the line of whichever government is in power in Israel? Because it seems like kind of a conundrum that American Jews, by and large, I think by super-duper majorities, consider themselves liberals. And yet somehow the Israel lobby, which supposedly represents American Jews to some great degree, seems to support the most Likudnik kind of policies.
I would think many of the same Jews who are able to support reformist or left liberal candidates in American politics nevertheless see it as their duty to be loyal, and by loyal one should mean uncritical, towards whatever policies Israel regards as necessary. So the perspective on American politics and the perspective on Israel, and they don't look as if they should cohabit in the same person, but in many supporters of AIPAC they do. Obama got, in the last election, 77% of the votes of American Jews, but if you look at the left liberal and truly fine newspaper that's the main news organ of Israel, Haaretz, you know, during the lead-up to the election, it reflected an extremely wary Israeli sense of what Obama might mean for the future of Israel. The sentimental favorite in Israel was certainly McCain, in a way that he was not among American Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I always wonder about that, too, and I guess this is skipping to the end of the article, but you point out that, you know, this is a self-destructive kind of policy, that if I was the one in charge over there or whatever, that kind of thing, what you want to do is make peace with your neighbors.
Yep.
They got the Saudi peace plan, and virtually all parties are willing, among, hedging on some negotiation or another, but are basically willing to recognize 67 borders and do the two-state solution and all that kind of thing. If this state is to exist for the next, you know, whatever, 500 years or that kind of thing into the indefinite future, then they can't have a position of dominance and enmity with all the people in all the neighboring states from here on out. It just doesn't make sense. That's not sustainable. They have to give up the West Bank and Gaza, don't they?
Well, Gaza they have given up, but they have not given up, you know, what to call it, a kind of aggressive guardianship of it that includes intermittent attacks.
Yeah, they just turned it into a prison. They didn't really let it go.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I mean, the it's been said by lots of commentators, Robert Dreyfus for one, but, you know, people who write about this, that the elements necessary for a two-state solution are known to all. It is, you know, a Jerusalem that is held by both Israel and Palestine. It is removal of Jewish-Israeli settlements from the West Bank and a return to 1967 borders. And it is a limited right of return for Palestinians who lost their residences and place to live in 1948. That will end up being token, I think, but they can't let them all back. But with, alongside that, some serious reparations for Palestinians whose property has been expropriated in the years between 1948 and 2009. Everyone knows that those are the elements. But it is talked about back and forth as if it were the most intricate and insoluble of problems. And, of course, right now the newest point of obstruction is the supposed existential threat constituted by Iran against Israel and the desire by the Israeli government for very large point-by-point assurances from the United States to assist Israel against the threat of Iran acquiring its first nuclear weapon.
Well, boy, there's a few things there. I guess I can try to tie them together with you mentioned the influence of Congress of the Israel lobby. And, of course, they held their big rally over the weekend. And I guess this kind of ties back into the scandal, as you mentioned. You think the dropping of the charges of Rosen Weissman was related to the AIPAC convention. But more than half, I read, literally more than half of the Congress was at the AIPAC convention over the weekend, including Newt Gingrich, who's trying to make a comeback.
Are you saying something like 250 members of Congress?
Yeah, that's what I read anyway. I guess let me Google it and check my footnote, but that's what I read, that it was more than half of them showed up for it.
Wow.
And Newt Gingrich, of course, gave a speech talking about how, yeah, exactly, we need to have war with Iran. That does seem to be part of the major thrust of the AIPAC conference, which I didn't watch the whole thing or anything, but there's this Iran Diplomatic Enhancement Act, they call it, which mandates sanctions on any company that exports refined gasoline to Iran.
Yeah, they're going to try to choke it off from oil resources, right?
Well, at least they got Winston Smith to write the title of the thing for him, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea the attendance was that high. There never has been, I think, anything quite like these annual AIPAC conventions as they've now grown in importance. They're covered as major events in the Israeli newspapers, the American AIPAC conventions. Now, I gather from reading about it in philipweiss.org and some other places that you may have been reading, too, that two major themes at this convention have been to mention but slow down very much any talk about a two-state solution. Ehud Olmert, the just stepped down Prime Minister of Israel, talked very pointedly about the necessity and the urgency of a two-state solution just before he went into Gaza to make that assault. Then that was a distraction that removed everyone's minds from Olmert's words of advice and warning. But like many Israeli politicians, he seems to be completely a split character, and it's very hard to work out how it adds up. But so the new theme from the more right-wing government forged by Benjamin Netanyahu is to allow to be mentioned the two-state solution, Palestinian nationhood, but to see that as something in the distant future, when the Palestinian people acquire their own ability to be economically independent and can't control themselves and govern themselves. There's a lot of quasi-colonialist talk about the Palestinians as peoples in their nonage, who've not yet come into the kind of political decencies that are necessary for modern government. That's one part. The other part is Iran, and that Iran is the imminent threat, and everything regarding Israeli readiness to deal on Palestine will depend on American support of Israel's sense of the urgency of countering the Iranian threat. So there's, you know, the from what one gathers reading the newspapers, the Obama administration wants to make U.S. support of Israel dependent on going forward towards a two-state solution. It's not necessary to have any elaborate procedure, as people have been saying. It's known what's necessary. Whereas the Israeli approach is to say, no, everything about our dealings with the Palestinian idea depends on dealing right now with Iran.
Yeah, well, and it's a mystery to me. I still can't figure it out. I mean, in the 1980s especially, this is certainly post the Iranian Revolution, you know, Ronald Reagan sold missiles to the Iranians through Israel. And
yep.
There's all kinds of, you know, relationships where the Israelis have been able to deal with the mullahs since the revolution there, at least at certain points. And again, like, even the Israeli government doesn't dispute the idea that Iran's nuclear program is what we all know it to be, the safeguarded program at Natanz and Bushehr. They don't really assert a secret program exists.
Yep.
And they want us to believe that this safeguarded program that's producing non-weapons-grade uranium is an existential threat. I'm honestly puzzled by it. I mean, honestly, you know, like Scott Ritter's book, he says that they have this theory of Israeli intelligence that's a lot like just being a conspiracy theorist, really, called Concepcion, where they just kind of say this is tantamount to that. If they have any nuclear capacity, that's tantamount to having a nuclear weapons capacity, even though it's really not, and they know it's really not. But that doesn't seem like much of an explanation. I mean,
yeah.
I honestly don't understand it. Dave, do you?
I can only make two observations to add to that, and no, I don't understand it. I think that there's obscurity in where Iran has advanced to on acquiring the ability to make their first nuclear weapon. Israel has scores of them. I think the shortest estimate put it at a year or 18 months, the longer ones from American intelligence at 3 to 5 years. So, you know, the urgency being pressed on us as an urgency of the next few weeks or few months is really exaggerated and deliberately exaggerated. But second, from all one can tell, in Israel itself, the fear is genuine. For whatever reasons, for reasons that have to do with national psychology and the history and, you know, reiterated storytelling of the true history of the Jews in the 20th century and so on. I mean, one finds credit given to the urgency of the Iranian threat by scholars who are trustworthy in other ways. Zev Sternhell, for one, in an article I remember reading about 6 months ago, something like, I think, two-thirds of Israelis agree in regarding this as a massive and close to emergency threat. Now, what gives that, you know, dramatic or melodramatic point is the old style anti-Semitic utterances of the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad.
Mm-hmm.
But he is not, as everyone knows, the man who holds actual reins of power in Iran. He may be forced into retirement by having someone else elected in the election just coming up in Iran. And I gather this was one topic of discussion toward the end of AIPAC, that there was a little bit of consternation that if they lose Ahmadinejad as somebody to help explain their cause. Oh, yeah, it was Kenneth Pollack, liberal war party man, who was making statements to this effect, that Ahmadinejad was very good for the aggressive Israeli cause, and if they had to deal with another president who seemed more moderate, Israel would have a harder time making its case.
Wow, you hear that, folks? The moderate's the enemy. Better to have Ahmadinejad to better justify military conflict, I guess.
Well, I think with it goes just the obscurity and almost superstitious distrust of what the real intentions of the mullahs who hold the power might be. And there, you know, we're all in the dark, aren't we? Because through the Bush years, there has been so little contact with Iran.
Well, and I think it's a safe bet to assume the worst about mullahs. I mean, I don't favor any theocracy in the world. I can't imagine that they're reasonable gentlemen or anything like that. Who knows what kind of crazy thing they're about. But still, we have to measure objective reality and not, you know, our worst imaginations.
And we, when you say we, being citizens of the United States,
yeah,
who have separate duties, separate responsibilities, and ought to be able to maintain separate perceptions of the world from our allies, the Israelis. But, I mean, another sort of imponderable and something difficult to figure out the truth of in this area is you know, what Israel's... Take the top people, take the most suspicious, the most power-oriented, the most realistic Israelis, whoever they are in Mossad or elsewhere. What do they really think of Iran? What's the real danger they fear about Iran? I doubt that they indulge in fantasies about Iran being a suicide nation, which as soon as it comes into possession of one nuclear weapon, will send it over to Israel and have the whole nation of Iran annihilated in return. Hard to believe that. What they speak of more often is the fact that Iran subsidizes and supplies two groups that commit acts of terror against Israel, that is Hezbollah and Hamas, and it's, I think, generally felt that or reported that Iran has a large role supporting those groups. So that's a reason to fear Iran that might not be vivid enough to Americans, so you have to make up this existential threat story. But going back to the Iran-Contra puzzle, which you mentioned a few moments ago, look, there in the mid-80s, an Israeli businessman or two was acting as middleman between the U.S. and Iran to help get, you know, American tow missiles into the hands of Iran to fight their war with Iraq in return for payments which the Reagan administration was using to subsidize their illegal war south of the border against the communists, the Contras in Nicaragua. Crazy business, but the Israeli role in it is sometimes forgotten. It had to do with what they then called the doctrine of the perimeter. Israel's, you know, enemies in the 70s had included Egypt, Jordan, etc. I mean, that was relatively normalized by the Carter-Sadat Begin negotiations, but there's still fear of immediate surroundings of Israel, including countries like Syria and the always unreliable Lebanon. What are we to do about them? The doctrine of the perimeter said Israel has to make secret connections, alliances of some sort, with Arab countries that are outside the immediate vicinity. And Iran was one of the choices. So there's a history of negotiations, not well known, but, you know, more than a thin history, going back to the 80s. And it's hard to read now the meaning of that. There's a book about it, and a good book by Trita Parsi called Treacherous Alliance, And, you know, he who is an Iranian is a voice on this subject I would trust more than almost anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems, too, like this whole thing about Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas being the problem and Iran's backing of them from the Israeli point of view, and the subject gets conflated with the nuclear fear and all these kinds of things. It seems like even there, the war party in Israel and in America have adopted the silly strategy of saying all these groups are all one big conspiracy against Israel and that kind of thing, when it ought to be pretty easy to separate Hezbollah from Syria, and pretty easy to separate Syria from Iran, and pretty easy to separate Palestinian resistance, Hamas,
Hamas has a real hold on Gaza, and I don't know if it's going to be easy to separate.
Well, you could separate Iran from them, if not them from Gaza itself.
And very possibly Hamas itself is splittable. That is to say, given a large enough group of people, or even given a medium-sized group of people, a lot of them will prefer peace to war. Living by the regiment of a day-to-day terrorist is very romantic and glamorous to some tastes, but not to most. And, the extreme obstruction placed in the way of forming a Palestinian state has been a great recruiting help for Hamas, let alone what Israel did to Gaza at the end of December and in early January. So, I mean, yeah, if a solution were wanted, a solution would seem to be possible. But this is just where, I have an easier time explaining the American inertia that goes along with Israel than what popular opinion is like today in Israel and the reasons why it's so. I think American public opinion, the discourse of the mainstream media, those 200-and-something congressmen coming out to AIPAC, I mean, they're doing things the way things have been done, and they're not really adding it up. Oh, sure, we can put a blockade of oil against Iran. Iran, you know, took our hostages in the 70s. Everybody remembers that. They're perennial enemies. Somehow we'll come out of this. Well, Israel is our ally. I just don't think people are reflecting on it and what it means from step to step and the anger it's going to arouse in that region. Within Israel, I mean, one factor has to be the growing influence of very orthodox and, you know, as we would think it, almost pre-Enlightenment citizens of Israel, many of them coming from Russia, who have changed the balance of the Israeli electorate in the last 20 years or so. This is not a much reported feature of Israeli politics, but if you read their newspapers in English, you know, Haaretz, Jerusalem Post, you find it staring at you that, you know, when we Westerners, we Americans, think about Israel, we think about somebody like Abba Iban, or anyway, we think about the American educated, very charming and you know, comprehensible Benjamin Netanyahu. He goes over great on TV. He seems just like an American politician, and in many ways he is. But that's not, that's, even he is not an adequate reflection of these very orthodox, very narrow, very superstitious, and very fearful people who are part of Israeli politics, just like the evangelicals in the South are part of our politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, what exactly do you mean by pre-Enlightenment?
I mean that the idea of a secular state is alien to them, and to the extent possible, they will make Israel into more and more of a religious state. The idea of Hamas now having to acknowledge that Israel is the state of the Jews, it's just very peculiar, because the whole founding of the state after 1948 was built on the complexity of wanting to be at once Western and secular, but also a homeland for the Jews, since they needed one, since the persecutions had revealed their full and horrible length during World War II. So, I mean, I mean by pre-Enlightenment, anti-secular and tribal.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, by the way, I wanted to drop two footnotes here for my wild assertion. First is Michael Crowley, I don't know how he pronounces it, at the New Republic. Biden at AIPAC is the name of his blog entry.
Uh-huh.
He says that more than half, including half, he says. And then the New York Times, Neil A. Lewis at annual meeting pro-Israel group reasserts clout, says more than half.
Wow.
The members of the House and Senate attended Monday night's dinner.
Yeah. Well, while we're on Biden, you know, it should be mentioned that both John Kerry and Joseph Biden came to that convention for the purpose of mentioning the two-state solution and telling the audience at AIPAC that Israel ought to be serious about evacuating the West Bank settlements and about creating the possibility of an independent state for Palestine, and to do it on a much faster method than had been allowed in the Bush years. And it seems that Kerry and Biden were both rather tepidly received, though politely, when they said these things. Now, it can't but be that both Kerry and Biden were, you know, not just permitted, but asked to say these things by people in the Obama administration to get it out in the open.
Well, that's a very important point. This is something I've been puzzled about. You know, I guess I can imagine Hillary Clinton being just as pleased starting a war as negotiating a peace, as long as, you know, it makes her look good or whatever. And I just wonder about this Obama team. I mean, I guess we all have to breathe a sigh of relief. At least it's not Dick Cheney and Elliot Abrams running this policy.
Yeah,
and Condoleezza Rice and these horrible people. But do you think that they, I kind of am getting the message, and I'm sorry because I'm not yet familiar with Biden's comments there that you mentioned, but I have seen where George Mitchell and Hillary Clinton have both made some pretty stern statements about, no, we're really serious about a two-state thing. Do you think they really mean it?
I think they really mean it, yes. Do they really have the courage to sustain it? I hope so, but I don't know. The Obama team on the Middle East is put together with lots of very familiar, very friendly to AIPAC and friendly to Likud presences like Dennis Ross. But it's also got George Mitchell, who's, I believe, of Lebanese background, and whose attitude towards Ireland was towards making peace even with former terrorists. So, I mean, that was an interesting choice for that position. And Hillary Clinton's hard to read on this because, as a senator from New York, she did so much to assure support from Jewish donors, and her attitude on Iran has always been very aggressive. But as you say, Hillary Clinton is so political a creature, it's very hard to read the degree of sincerity in any one gesture of hers.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is that relief factor that's we almost, it prevents us from thinking when we look at Obama and what he's doing. It is true that these people seem more deliberate, able to consider more things, not rash, unlike the group that we're in under Bush. And of course, that's true of the president too. But it will be the great test of the first year of his administration, I think, how he comes forward with Israel and how he's able to sustain an approach to the problem, which Israel's capable of consenting to, but which will be seen as quite different from just uncritical support like that of Rice and Bush. And I really wonder. It will take courage.
So now let's see if you can, I guess, sort of give us the broad outlines of the Rosen-Weissman case and the big news that the charges have been dropped, and the importance that you see in, you know, the significance of this to, say, I don't know, the average American citizen.
Well, this is a case that was brought by the Justice Department under the Bush administration against two lobbyists who worked for AIPAC, Stephen Rosen and Keith Weissman. I believe it was done with the help of a sting by a worker in the Defense Department named Lawrence Franklin, who ended up pleading guilty and being sentenced to, and this is in 2006, to 12 years and 7 months in federal prison and a $10,000 fine. I don't think he's yet serving that sentence because it was dependent on his testimony in the trial of Weissman and Rosen, and now charges, as of just a couple days before the beginning of the AIPAC conference about a week ago, charges were officially dropped against these two AIPAC lobbyists. Now, the contradiction or the troubling details of the case, which came out in a Time story that I wrote about in that post for Huffington Post a few days ago, are that there was a large element of the Justice Department that was for continuing the case, that believed they had a strong case, and this included the head of the Washington office of the FBI, Joseph Persichini, who actually let himself be quoted to the effect that he was furious that the case was dropped. Other hints were given in that very delicately written Times story, which is meant to sort of smooth things over, but as often with the Times, you could read the Times against the Times, between, you know, between one paragraph and another, there were hints of what the real story might be. That, you know, the Obama administration had sent in a couple of new appointees to run interference and make sure that the strongest case was heard for dropping the charges against Weissmann and Rosa. Now, that last part is my conjecture, but if you read the story, it's what appears from the story, and then we're told that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, accepted the recommendation of the prosecutors that the case be dropped. But I also trace these charges back to an earlier FBI investigation of AIPAC and of the Defense Department, which touched on Lawrence Franklin, that had to do with some of the same personalities in their circle, and Ahmed Chalabi, the neoconservative favorite candidate to head a new government in Iraq after the U.S. invasion. He lost out for various reasons, the last of them being he couldn't gain enough votes to even be a blip on the screen of the politics of Iraq. But Chalabi remains, you know, a major force in Iraq, partly through U.S. patronage, and some of the people who were patronizing him most assiduously seem to have been close to AIPAC as well. So there was an FBI investigation of Chalabi and AIPAC in this earlier time, which was also rather mysteriously dropped. So these two things are, I think, connected in that what you see in both is signs of an internal conflict in the U.S. government, in the investigatory and justice branches of the U.S. government, where there are people who see the Israel lobby and its, you know, outlying friends as a serious danger to American autonomy of action. And those who are working, on the other hand, for policies that absolutely require the Israel lobby and its agents to remain strong. So I see this as one more manifestation of that conflict that's, I think, still going on. I'm sure it hasn't been resolved just by the fact that these charges are dropped.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that really is the interesting context, is that where, you know, Jane Harmon and the Rosen and Weissmann and Franklin case, I mean, I guess we got to admit that most Americans don't know anything about the Rosen Weissmann case. It hasn't had much play on TV. I mean, if they decide to keep up with it, they can. But other than that, I think most people probably don't know.
No, absolutely not. Yep.
But like you're saying, this is, I guess, part of what Justin Raimondo calls the transmission belt of treason, where we're not just talking about Israel's overt ops in the form of AIPAC, you know, putting pressure on Congress people through petitions and phone calls and letters to get them to vote for certain legislation or whatever. This is where we get into covert operations. And
yep.
As you're saying, there's this FBI investigation, which it seems to be more or less anyway, and I can't really tell. You actually cite some good quotes out of some old Washington Post articles about this, where it seems like this investigation reminds me of the Sybil Edmonds thing. Like, it's all kind of one big counterintelligence thing going on here, and it involves the guys in Doug Feith's policy shop. It involves people at AIPAC. It involves the Turkish lobby, which, of course, is very close to AIPAC and all these things.
Yeah, I can't do more than that, and admittedly that remains vague, but there's a pattern. There is a lot of investigating going on that ends up coming to nothing or not being able to come to committees. Waxman, I believe Representative Waxman, sort of promised to call Sybil Edmonds and then never did. Is that right?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, so things that almost come to the point of being in public, they're recognized as being important by a congressman or by this or that newspaper, but then they're dropped. So there are forces investigating it, and there are forces very interested in protecting these relations from being investigated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a good deal like, you know, the under-the-surface organized conflict one saw in the 30s and 40s when the forces at work were different. But it's very hard to talk about because the newspapers don't cover it. They cover it if you read page 12 of the Times or page 14 of the Washington Post. But, yeah, one has to go to places like, antiwar.com for one, or, you know, columns by Philip Giraldi in the American Conservative and whatnot to get to get a bit deeper impression of what's under the surface. Yeah, it's as if they're two separate histories, you know. There's the history we read in the newspapers, and there's something else going on that might be interesting to know about.
Well, you know, I think it's one of my serious character flaws that I can't seem to ever get desensitized to this stuff. So it's almost as shocking as if I was just finding out that politicians sometimes lie or something. When I find out that as Philip Giraldi characterizes it, the Israelis basically successfully made an agent out of not just a member of Congress,
yeah,
but the woman who was in line,
yeah,
to be the chair of the House,
yeah,
Intelligence Committee. I mean, if any other country's intelligence service did that, wouldn't that be the biggest story ever,
yeah,
or something? And yet somehow this thing turned into like a conspiracy theory about Porter Goss over at Laura Rosen's blog and then disappeared.
Yeah, there was somebody had a sentence on, I think it was on the Weiss blog, saying, you know, what if the name of the agent had been Ha Jin Lee or something like that, and the congressman had been Chinese? Would it have gone off the front pages so soon? I don't think so. So, yeah, there is very much of a double standard where the sheer strength and the sheer unexamined character of the American-Israel identification. And it's a mutual identification that's much stronger just than American Jews. It goes further than that. This prevents these stories from being discussed adequately.
Are you familiar with the Good case against the AIPAC case? There are two journalists that I'll name who I have great respect for, as any regular listener to this show knows, Glenn Greenwald and the other Scott Horton at Salon and Harper's Magazine's websites, respectively, there. And both of them say that it's a good thing that this case was dropped, because whatever you think of Rosen and Weissman and AIPAC, the way this case was constructed to be prosecuted by the Justice Department was going to criminalize leaking classified information to journalists.
Yeah.
And now, no one ever seems to, at least to my satisfaction, explain why that would be the case. I thought what was at issue here was they were passing stolen secrets to the Israeli embassy full of Mossad agents who were giving it to the government of Israel.
Yeah, well, this was an argument I heard made by some liberal lawyer friends of mine during the prosecution of Louis Libby, where, you know, a journalist was jailed for not being willing to share her sources, and the idea was this would become a precedent and a pattern for other prosecutors if they followed Fitzgerald's path, and lawyers are very sensitive to that. It may have been an unwinnable case on other grounds, although clearly some people in the FBI, and I suspect some of the people close to the prosecution, were not so sure it was unwinnable. But I think your perspective and mine can afford to be different from that of lawyers who are judging, well, did this make good law? Because we're looking at it as American citizens interested in the independence of action of our country and interested, for example, in not getting us into more unnecessary wars. Few wars are necessary, and they are the worst things that nations do. And what you're describing, you know, you said your sense of shock, but should I really be shocked? It's just like politicians lying. Well, it's not quite just like politicians lying. I mean, the idea that I own my own actions and that my actions have certain effects in the world in relation to my being understood as what I am in the world. That sense of connection between me and my actions is the very essence of autonomy in morals and autonomy in the judgment of personal or collective character. And when we discover, you know, in our personal lives that an action we thought was done on our own was actually done at the bidding of forces that influenced our judgment in ways we had no idea of, but that actually concerted us towards, let's say, getting married to a person who turned out to be not very appropriate. But lots of hints were made that this was just the right person. I mean, it is the subject of a great American novel, The Portrait of a Lady, how that is done to someone. And the sense of that impalpable but really terrifying loss of freedom of control over your actions, I think it does shock the mind. And what happens when these things are repeated and repeated and repeated is that one just gets desensitized. It's a habit. Everybody's used to it. You know, why aren't we used to it?
Everybody, that's David Bromwich. He teaches literature at Yale University. He's written on politics and culture for The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Review of Books, and many other magazines. He's the editor of Edmund Burke's Selected Writings on Empire, Liberty, and Reform, and co-editor of the Yale University Press edition of On Liberty. Thank you very much for your time on the show today, David.
Thanks, Scott. Good talking to you.
Oh, and I meant to mention also, you can find him at huffingtonpost.com/David-Bromwich.